Alright, so the theme this whole week is apostasy high and low. And that's not simply because the two are happening at the same time, but what we're going to see is that the two are, at the end of the day, saying the same thing. You will be amazed how much Joseph Smith has in common with Hegel, for example. It's almost like they're reading off the same sheet, but one of them is told, you guys talk to the academics and you guys talk to the simple people on the frontier. They weren't, sort of. But the lines do run parallel, so we'll see that. So first we're going to tackle in academia, but really just sort of a summary of the whole era. And it was at the height of the Second Great Awakening that the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville famously traveled through America and wrote his book, Democracy in America, in 1830, in which he stated, there is no country in the world in which the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of men than in America. And so it would seem, at the turn of the 19th century, that Voltaire and Paine and others were revealed as false prophets of modernity. Not only did the beginning of the next century not witness the death of religion and the banishment of the Bible, as they had prophesied, but Voltaire's house was converted into a Bible translating society. And another visitor to America, Mary Winslow of England, would observe, there is not a country in the world where religion and religious intelligence are so constantly and prominently brought before the attention as this, end quote. But the question we want to ask is, what sort of a religious attention span was there beneath the snapshots that these visitors had? The doctrinal withering of the revival season, centering in New Haven, had already been noted. So too has the meeting of enthusiasm at Cane Ridge in Kentucky. I think it was on a Sunday that we'd mentioned that. We'll bring it up again. But what occurred on the frontiers as a result of these first epicenters of a second awakening? Well, first and most obviously, the geography of the Second Great Awakening far exceeded the first, when it comes to the American map at least. Now, that's not saying much, because the west of the First Awakening, to their west, was a French army, with angry natives as front lines for the French. To the east was an ocean. So really, that might be sort of a superficial difference. So, think of it like this. The First Great Awakening was along the seaboard, and mostly concentrated up here in terms of its most supernatural manifestations and so on. The Second Great Awakening not only extends from New Haven, but has centers in Virginia and Carolina, but really the center is Kentucky and Tennessee and these states, and it pushes outward like this. But its epicenter is much bigger, and it covers and affects a bigger region during that time. But as I said, it could be hard on the First Great Awakening for that. There were things that were limiting them physically. More impressively, though, this Second Great Awakening lasted longer in a constant succession, crossed over more denominational lines. Again, that's superficial. The denominations were created in many of those cases in that context. And it knocked over more social ills as well. So there are things that should be noted like that. Aside from a general compilation of accounts published in 1802 in Philadelphia, the first popular account of this second season was not until a guy named Humphrey wrote Revival Sketches and Manual in 1859, while other volumes tended to focus on only one region or one period. So there really wasn't... It's interesting, for so late of an event, we don't have as many accounts that are definitive of the Second Great Awakening as we do of the first. Because people were just on the move, and they weren't given to scholarship. And so there's not really a definitive, at least in the first century, of it, of the entire movement. It'd be fair to locate the Second Awakening on a timeline at 1798 to 1826, if we're collecting the best testimony of those in all of the denominations, with the period of 1826 to the Civil War constituting its aftermath in the spawning of the rest of modern American religion. So really, two distinct periods. Let's put it down here. 1798 to 1826 being the revival season itself, and then sort of the aftermath, 1826. Really, you can go all the way to 1900 and with a westward expansion from where that's happening, to see the effects, the aftermath, the creation of the American religion. It's that latter period and its connection with the first that is a subject apparently too sensitive for general church histories to tackle with too much honesty. It usually takes secular historians to sketch this out. And here's why. This was the apostasy of the lowlands of Christianity among those who were not cultured, a demographic that Francis Schaeffer would later place on the bottom of the stairs of his famous staircase model of cultural history. So if we were to understand the apostasy of the Christian faith in the modern West as a whole, we have to take a walk up to the top stairs first, in the universities of a teetering Christendom. So that's what we're going to go first today, is we're going to start up here. And notice this is happening roughly at the same time. So a lot of people in the frontier are not reading these guys that are going on at the same time. They can't. They wouldn't, often. But they are reading some figures from a century or more past. But we're going to start up here because we're going to find that they're doing, with a very sophisticated mind, the same thing, ultimately, that they're doing down there on the man on the street. So I'm going to call this, I already called this first section Apostasy High, as a laugh because I thought Apostasy High School or something. What is that? But it just means at the top of the stairs in the academic community. And another name that you might give for this, for the faith, and you'll see why, this is not just a play on words. I like to call it Kantianity rather than Christianity. And you'll see why as we go forward. All the theologies that come out of Central Europe, and a lot of them even in the English-speaking world, after that are entirely reliant on the philosophy of Kant. So let's see how we got there. Christian scholars had already answered the call of the rationalist and the empiricist critics in the century before this. For example, among the English, Joseph Butler and William Paley, at the beginning of the 19th century, in particular, would give to the English believer an apologetic, a defense, that would add to the scaffolding of Christian evidentialism that Grotius had already begun. So a couple of books. One guy, Butler, who I mentioned, he wrote a book called Analogy of Religion, Natural and Revealed to the Constitution of Nature. That was in 1736. So the title really speaks for itself. Truth is an analogy in religion, the Word and the World, natural and revealed to the Constitution of Nature. And so Butler's whole argument was, look at the world. It's just like the kind of world that reflects this kind of a God. Now, already there's an inroad to deism in that, because you're focusing attention on God's general revelation as if that's the authority. It's just a short step from that to an embarrassment over the Scriptures or direct supernatural intervention. And so you're proving the truth of Christianity by nature. This is what presuppositionalists look at. They look back at the evidentialist tradition and say, you see, that's what happens when you focus on general revelation. In other words, to truths that we all have in common, share in common, can admit to, stuff like that. Well, part of their criticism is right. It did tend toward deism in those minds. The titles of books by Locke at the beginning of this era and Kant at the end of it provide telling bookends on this entire age of reason. Locke's 1695 book, The Reasonableness of Christianity, argued in that same way as Butler. But at the time you get to the end of that period, Kant's book, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, tells you that what began as an apologetic and thinning out Christian truth that way ended at saying that whatever revelation there is has to accord with the higher court of reason. And the upshot of the Enlightenment for many a conservative Christian in retrospect has been a progression of the light of truth in this idea, where you start thinking, I actually have a chart that I think is a good one. I think I'm going to add it to Doctrine and Division, because I think what was happening here, and this is what people like Michael Horton are looking at, I'm just going to erase this for now, in his book, The Christian Faith, people who are very conservative who nevertheless criticize the big idea concept. In their minds, here's what they see, something that really was happening psychologically throughout the course of this period. It starts out with the idea that truth is something that is that appeals to the internal. We're not animals. You don't get it by osmosis. This light comes directly to our mind. It's something that's internal. Therefore, it's something that is individual. It can be accessed individually. So you think for yourself. Therefore, so these therefores are sort of these irresistible inferences. If that's true, then truth, God's revelation in the mind, is independent. If it's individual, it's every man for himself. And if it's every man for himself, every man is a law unto himself, therefore autonomous. So you see the slippery slope. You see the irresistible inference in the Enlightenment idea. The light of truth communicated to the inner life of the mind, to the individual alone. Notice how different this is than what Jonathan Edwards was saying in his divine and supernatural light directly imparted to the soul, namely to the individual soul by God. People have a hard time with that thing. I guarantee you that sermon is not one of the favorite sermons of Edwards among the new Calvinists today. My personal favorite. Probably not theirs. Because in their minds they see something that's an Enlightenment idea. It's internal, therefore it's individual. Therefore it's independent, therefore it's autonomous. In other words, many Christians, now especially, have seen a necessary tendency in Western theology that goes all the way back to Plato, and which was exploded with Descartes' rationalism in the 17th century and down to the present day. Enlightenment comes to mean this. Reason comes to mean this progression. This is a progression. It's a slippery slope, so that each step becomes a beguiling slide to the next. One historian of theology built upon the quote that the Enlightenment was man's exodus from his self-incurred tutelage. So here's another psychological selling point of the Enlightenment during that time. That the Enlightenment was man's exodus from his self-incurred tutelage. So in other words, they're saying about religion, that was useful in its day. Like a schoolmaster, kind of like the law to Israel, a tutor, until the time of maturity came. And so this historian goes on to say, to notice that the definition went on to explain that the state of tutelage, the inability to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another person, could be characterized as self-incurred if its cause lies not in any weakness of the understanding, but in indecision and lack of courage to use the mind without the guidance of another. So you see, when at the core of the Enlightenment was free thinking, which comes to mean independent without the help, of another, of an authority. Any kind of help, anything that comes from outside of me is me not thinking for myself. You see that, you hear that, you feel that in the kind of skepticism that exists on the man in the street. In other words, there was a psychological warfare going on in the Enlightenment case, which appealed to affluent man's fears of being thought intellectually weak, dependent, gullible. To have evolved beyond the religious outlook was to have matured past the state of the schoolmasters of mysticism and authority. Nobody played upon this with more respectability than David Hume. Hume's dates are 1711 to 1776. Hume was the model of a dispassionate, brave, modern person, lopping off his own empiricist foundations by challenging our ability to know the power behind cause and effect. Now, this tended to foster skepticism only by implication, or for the learned. He would lay a more explicit foundation for the anti-supernaturalism of the next century in a book called The Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. And he had to publish it, well, somebody else had to publish it for him, in 1776, because he didn't want to publish it in his lifetime, because it was that scandalous. And that's where he, you know, introduces the problem of evil in its most articulate form. But in the final section on miracles, the most famous part, he charges that the evidence for any miracle, say the resurrection, for example, ought to exceed even the normal standards of evidence, since for so spectacular a claim, there ought to be universal attestation. As it is, there is none. He would say nobody has ever seen a bona fide miracle. And therefore, you shouldn't trouble yourself with an empirical inquiry into one. They are philosophically impossible. Now, later philosophers would come to see that this commits the fallacy of circular reasoning. But at the time, the error in the skeptic's logic was swept under the rug for the sake of the more alluring opportunities for the critic. There was a guy in Scotland who wanted to argue against Hume at this point, and that was Thomas Reid. So the impetus for Thomas Reid and his common sense realism is some degree of embarrassment and fear that Hume's criticisms would lead to the end of everything. And I'll put Reid right here. He's arguing against Hume. And he's not going to be as important at this stage as Kant will be, but they're all reacting to Hume. So let's just get to Kant. Another reaction to Hume would be more epic-making. We'll come back to Reid when we get to the frontier, because that's really where he's important. In Prussia, a young student of the rationalist Christian Wolff by the name of Immanuel Kant would be, as Kant would later say, when I read Hume, I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers. He was just a regular rationalist when he was in college. But he starts to read Hume, and he realizes what Hume's saying. He said, man, this doesn't leave us with anything. Because he's picking up, for example, Hume's other book, An Inquiry into Human Understanding, and the very last words really say it all. Hume basically said, pick up any book from the Middle Ages, the Scholastics, the old medieval theologians, and examine any one of their sentences. And he asks the question, does it contain purely a priori analytical, like 2 plus 2 equals 4, or if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C? Is it that kind of a truth, an analytical truth? No. And then he says, does it contain matter of facts, or in other words, empirical data? There are 6 people in this room. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. No. Then he says, commit it then to the flames, for it contains nothing but sophistry and illusion. So what was Hume saying? Any statement to be meaningful, any statement about anything, has to be either one of two things. It has to be purely analytical. So I'll put up here, purely. Or what Kant would later call synthetic, but let's just use the word empirical. Sensory. If it's not one of those two things, it is a nonsense statement. It's about nothing. It's not about formal truths or empirical stuff that's really there. What's the problem with that? Well, Kant wasn't interested in that. If Kant would have been a little older, maybe, instead of just doing his studies, he might have realized, wait a minute, that statement is neither purely analytical nor purely empirical. Falls by its own weight. It's self-refuting. And later philosophers would see that. And then go on to regurgitate the same garbage in the 20th century and call it the verification principle. Until the guy that did that, Iyer, practically on his deathbed, had to realize, oh, I just regurgitated what Hume said, and we just built an entire civilization and mocked Christians for 300 years on that basis, to the point where Christians are too dumb to realize that we have nothing to our case. Oops. But too late by then. Well, Kant sensed the practical problem without moving deeper into its logical problem. It would lead to skepticism. I must do something about it. Well, it would really lead to skepticism. So he wasn't interested in its logical problem. He saw its practical problem. And said, I gotta do something about this. Rationalism, purely analytical statements. Empiricism, purely empirical foundations and statements to our thinking. Neither of these will really work. And so Kant launched out on a rational empiricism. You see, there wasn't anybody around Kant in his religious background to help him, his Lutheran pietistic upbringing, to even whisper to him at this point that if such a statement leads to skepticism practically, it's precisely because the maxim itself is already slain by the same skepticism. And as I said, atheists and agnostics alike in secular philosophy departments now begrudgingly admit that this apex of Hume's epistemological assault is in fact self-contradictory. But Kant was too bothered for both sacred and secular reasons to put these couple of twos together. He would launch out on a rational empiricism, a synthesis of the two intellectual necessities. And so he starts off his main book, The Critique of Pure Reason, in 1781, by saying essentially, yes, all of our knowledge, the data of it, does come through sensory experience. But there already exists in the mind certain a priori categories, analytical preconditions for us to synthesize that sensory data that comes in. Otherwise, no sentence about anything would make sense. And so that first page of Kant's Critique, it's like, yeah, any Christian could say the same thing. That is the problem with Enlightenment thinking. However, he went beyond this. In that Critique of Pure Reason, he would divide all of reality into two tiers. The same two tiers that had been on the chalkboard of Western philosophy since Plato and Aristotle. A horizontal line that moves from left to right. An upper and lower story on either side of them. Charting out the thinkers of history, but more importantly, separating the eternal from the temporal, the immutable from the mutable, the upper story from the lower story, and the top floor he would call the noumenal, from that Greek word for spirit, noumen, and the bottom floor he would call the phenomenal. So this is the real world. He would acknowledge that in the same way that Plato would, and down here you have the world of appearances. So above that line, the noumenal, the real, what would he place up there? He would place such eternal objects as God, the self, love, immortality, final justice, and perhaps most importantly, what he called the thing in itself. The thing in itself. In other words, objects. Any objects. Not just God, but this piece of chalk, which the object is not on this plane. Now, a good sign that somebody has understood Kant is whether or not they grasp the meaning of this thing in itself. It's any object. So any A, which equals A. So let's just put up here to represent what he means by the thing in itself, that law of identity, A equals A. It necessarily means all of the other things in the monumental, in the noumenal. So this is a catch-all category. Anything, its thingness, it being itself, is what he meant by the thing in itself. So what we call a piece of chalk is merely the phenomenon, the level of local motion, where things have the appearance of objectivity, but which they're always changing. Strike the chalk against the blackboard, or even rub the chalk a little bit and see for yourself what's already going on before you did so. It's never the same object at any point on the space-time continuum. The essence of the object cannot be gotten to or held in what he called pure reason. It cannot be argued to without assuming an infinity of other truths which are presupposed by it. It therefore cannot be argued from without itself being a mere presupposition. So there's no way to an object by pure reason, and there's no way from an object, not objectively. And so all we are left with is to assume that some things exist as necessary conditions for very important activities like science and ethics. So, you see what he's saying here. All of our knowledge is something that simply has to presuppose something, some condition, some X. In fact, in logic, you have a conditional proof which assumes something and then says what kind of a world this would have to be, the necessary conditions which must exist, assuming or presupposing that. But all of our knowledge is circular. All of our knowledge begins with a presupposition. Now, he would acknowledge that not all presuppositions are equal, but how do you argue for or against any particular presupposition without presupposing something else? Okay? So, God was such a presupposition for him. So too is the final judgment. You couldn't have justice in this world unless you believe that there was a final justice. At any rate, if Kant was to be consistent, the thing in itself is just the catch-all meaning for absolutely anything. Consequently, the same lack of follow-through exhibited when he was so impressed by Hume apparently went missing when rehearsing his own argument as well. Because if nothing can be known by pure reason, then that nothing can be known by pure reason cannot be known by pure reason. We must simply assume that Kant was right for practical purposes. In other words, if we cannot know, beyond some presupposition, anything, then this is one of the things that you cannot know without presupposing something else. So Kant's argument, just as much as Hume's argument, is self-defeating. And any intelligent person that's been running Western civilization should have known that before the dead bodies started piling up. Now, why must we assume that Kant was right for practical purposes? Well, not many people bothered to ask, because science and ethics constituted the dream of enlightenment man, and who is to question that? Now, Kant did it for religious reasons too. I always say science and ethics are two reasons that we have to presuppose God and logic and cause and effect and stuff like that to do science and ethics. We don't really care so much about religion. Well, that was the case for a lot of people, but not for Kant. Kant did believe, he was a Lutheran, and he apparently didn't feel anything for a personal relationship, but he did, in his own way, believe in Christianity. And he actually made the statement that I had to kill reason in order to make room for faith. That's important because that same impulse shows up in Karl Barth later on in Neo-Orthodoxy. There's a motivation to create a subjective theology, to get some part of the Christian faith outside of the lens of the probing scholar, so that there's this core of the faith that we can hold without criticism. It's a really tempting thing to not have to deal with the critic, but it's cheating the process of apologetics. And so Kant's motive here, if he was genuine in that, shows back up in Neo-Orthodoxy in the 20th century. But that's important also to know that the motive, being a religious motive, does not therefore make it innocent or right. This frail man, who never left his hometown of Königsberg, was extended history's biggest hall pass, and the basic way that people in the West have thought about anything and everything has been wandering around aimlessly with him ever since. Kant was placed at the foundation without ever really being understood. He stands at the spring from which flowed Hegel, Marx, Darwin, Nietzsche, James, Freud, Dewey, the existentialists, the postmoderns. Whether it was the Anglo-American school, which attempted to live objectively on that bottom floor in science, or the continental school in Germany and France, which tended to have their phenomenal cake and eat their noumenal icing too, all of the theoretical thought following Kant in time, 19th, 20th century, followed him in their framework as well. They had no choice. He had gotten underneath their most basic problems with a lever of logic that they would not go back behind, and most of them didn't understand was at stake. The first thinker that concerns us existing in this flow of Immanuel Kant was the German theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher's dates are 1768 to 1834. Liberal theology begins where Kant's philosophy leaves off. So I'm going to draw that same board of Kant's divide, and I'm just going to change the terms. Not so when I say change the terms, what I mean is I'm going to bracket them. I'm going to unpack the drawers, so to speak. So let's just start by writing up on the board what Kant had already put there, the noumenal, the phenomenal, and we understand that what's up here is the objective, objects, things in themselves, and then down here is the appearances of anything. Well, that same thing, what the implications of that in theology, where the divide between the eternal picture of orthodoxy, that's the theoretical above, and the practical sense of orthopraxy, the ethical and the relational. So, if we follow Kant, I'm going to draw big brackets that just extend this way. so that you see all that's implied. So, if this is the case, what Kant is saying, then orthodoxy is above the line, orthopraxy, in other words, right practice, is below the line. Now, if Kant's whole scheme is contradictory, in other words, if the square circle is incoherent, what happens to your house that's made of a square circle? It poofs out of existence, doesn't it, before it ever gets off the ground, because it's not possible. So, guess what happens? Can this be coherent? For example, orthopraxy, right practice, right way to discipline my child, what do you mean? Well, I mean, this is, oh, you have a doctrine of childbearing. No, I don't. It's just practice. It's not doctrinal. Okay, that's what doctrine means. So, everything else that follows is going to collapse into that same square circle. It's going to make the same basic mistake. The eternal picture, the theoretical, that's another way that Kant himself, even before I get over here, is another way to say it. Theory up here, practice down here. And we don't talk like that, do we? Oh my goodness. We are rabid Kantians. Theory and practice. Well, Marxism works in theory, but not in practice. Wow. Where do I start? Presumably, Marxism was a theory about the real world. Could it be that it hasn't worked in practice because it doesn't work in theory? Because the numbers don't add up, quote unquote? Well, Schleiermacher would be educated in a Moravian school, and because their masters would take on the parental role for him once his mother died and his father left for life in the military, his experience with the mystical would be more positive than it was for Kant. Doubts begin to emerge concerning all of the supernatural elements of the faith. Yet, no, by the way, Schleiermacher's father sent him to this Moravian school because he wanted to protect him from the influences of the Enlightenment in higher education. And he thought these guys would be safe because they were an experiential sect. They didn't get involved in all that thinking. He did it. He already existed in Kant's flow. If your child is reflective at all, and you send him to a group of people that are unreflective, well, guess what? His soul is still going to leap up to find some alternative hardcore thinking. And so that is exactly what he did. He began to doubt all of these supernatural elements of the faith. But what he doubted was their theoretical framework, not the importance of the spiritual dimension. He just doubted their theoretical, objective knowability, their reality. And thus the theologian would substitute Kant's philosophical words with church words. The pure reason, practical reason divide would become the doctrine versus practice divide. And so theory and practice becomes doctrine versus practice. Or doctrine versus doing. To do doctrine is, in fact, not to do. It's an oxymoron, really. At least he's doing something, not this. Because, after all, you can't be reading a book chained to your study and love real people. Because apparently the only thing that you would ever do indoors away from people is reading a book. It's like that Julian Smith video. That's like a satire of people like us. I'm reading a book. Like, that's the only people. I thought of myself when I first saw that. Chained to my study. Now, the theologian of feeling would fall in love with a woman who was already married to a minister, but who was unhappy in that marriage and childless. And surely this was a situation into which this theology speaks directly. Their feelings, Schleiermacher and this woman, ought to be more essential than any theory about marriage. Interesting how it all always comes full circle, doesn't it? And thus false doctrine comes full circle to the explanation given by Jesus long ago in John 3:20. And modern men love subjective mumbling more than noumenal light because their deeds were evil. Romanticism was meant to be a reaction to rationalism. But its proponents in the early 19th century could only do so by accepting Kant's divide and consigning religion to the realm of feeling. However deep that feeling went, another thinker who is at least interesting at this point is the German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. And I am going to not put his name up there. Well, I'll put his name up there. But I'm not going to put him on this line because he doesn't really contribute anything to the progression of philosophy so much. He's interesting because he's so subjective in what he's the one that made the observation that civilizations in ascendancy are always objective in their basic thought orientation, and civilizations in decline are marked by a turn to the subjective. Yeah, that's a good enough. Even if he didn't say anything else good, that's good. He gets that. So his dates, by the way, are 1749 to 1832. His Faust is a kind of a Nietzsche before Nietzsche, except without all the real-life megalomania of Nietzsche. His main character is a sort of philosophical wanderer, kind of like the preacher in Ecclesiastes. Yet it's set in a world of the medieval era, in the medieval university, with all the medieval subjects. Man has passed in this story while learning nothing objective. He's passed through the halls of learning from philosophy to law to medicine to theology, at which point Faust throws his hands up and says, "Alas, theology too." In other words, theology didn't have anything either that these things have. But what's going on here is a progression. And you're going to see this in all the other thinkers. You see it in Ralph Waldo Emerson in America as well. He picks up on this in his Unitarian philosophy, reveling in this virtue of doubt and dividing up the history of rational man into three distinct periods. The Greek, which elevated nature to deity. The Christian, which downgraded eternity to our categories, which was arrogant. And now in the modern world, no matter how you end that sentence, the thing that's most interesting about these thinkers is they're always saying human philosophy and thinking is like a story in which we evolve from simpler to more complex forms. And now in the final stage, and by the way, when you and your smart friends show up, it's always the final stage. It's always the new heavens and new earth, even though they don't put it in those categories. But what's going on here, long before Darwin, is all these philosophies that are marked by the story of man getting smarter. And religion, and it's sort of a pat on the head to religion. Yeah, that was okay. Don't make fun of religion. That was useful back then when we needed a crutch to get to philosophy, which was useful when we needed a crutch to get to science, which was useful when we needed to get a crutch to German politics. Okay, that's where the story always ends for some reason. Don't know why. No one got tired of placing his own system at the end. None saw the irony that nobody was more of a millenarian, love that name, than the modernist. All had the second coming popping out of their own constructs. And nobody did this more famously than Hegel. And Hegel's dates are 1770 to 1831. Now, it is true that Hegel's work is as much of an attempt to save the world from Kant as Kant's was to save the world from Hume. But such a reaction only exists because the former thinker's work was seen to make a dent. In other words, the supreme compliment that Kant could give to Hume or that Hegel could give to Kant is that I actually have to spend my life refuting where they left off. Kant obviously believed that Hume actually had a point, and Hegel obviously believed that Kant had a point. So he's got to do something to save reason and Christianity and civilization. Hegel would accept Kant's divide, but reject that we must be left with agnosticism. Reason is real. In fact, everything is rational. Everything is an extension and a manifestation of logic in Hegel. But reason is often the future. So, if you want to understand Hegel, just take Kant's divide and turn it counterclockwise this way and put an arrow on the end. So, what he does is he calls the top floor spirit, Geist in the German. And eventually, this is revealed as what he calls the absolute. So, there is reason. Everything is rational. It's just off in the future. How do we get there? Well, he said, one generation has an idea, and he calls that our thesis. But where Western man used to believe that this meant A and non-A, such that its opposite, if this was true, was eternally false. They couldn't both be true at the same time in the same relationship. Well, Hegel says, No. That doesn't exist except off in the future. What we have is one generation that has a thesis, an A. Another generation comes along with an idea against this, an antithesis. Rational man, getting smarter, does so by chewing the meat and spitting out the bones of these two, getting the best of both and coming up with what he called a synthesis. Well, that synthesis is the new thesis, which has a new antithesis, which then chew the meat, spit out the bones, new synthesis. What's happening here? We're getting smarter. Everything's evolving and everything is rational. And more so every day. And more German every day. Not coincidentally. This might be called a rational evolution, even a rational eschatology. A survival of the synthesis. Again, a generation before Darwin. Christianity for Hegel was just the latest form of this spirit. It was the superior religion, but if you take him consistently, it would only be a new synthesis which would become a thesis and left behind. So the importance of Christianity was what the intelligent could make of it, what lies behind the dogma and the church symbols. And naturally, existentialist Lutheran theologians like Rudolf Bultmann in the next century, whether they knew it or not or liked it or not, would be very much thinking like Hegel in this sense. This rational eschatology gave philosophical scheme, blueprint, to an idea that was already on the market. In fact, it was the most concise summary of the Enlightenment's own story of redemption. Man begins in mysticism, progresses to philosophy, and would now be saved by science to be implemented in practice by politics. That's the progression. Mysticism to philosophy to science to the practice of politics, the state. So it was Hegel that said that the state is God's march through the world. Ancient priestcraft represented both the fall and the law portion of their narrative. A necessary evil in man's climb from the swamp to the stars. But if everything was evolving, here's how this shapes all 19th century theological thinking after that. If everything is evolving, and if man was a thing, then man was evolving. But if man is crowned by his reason, and reason begins in the religious, then the spiritual dimension, while not bad in itself, is also evolving. Remember this when you get to Julian Wellhausen with his documentary Hypothesis. By the way, notice the anti-Semitism in these German scholars and their condescending attitude toward what is Jewish. It's not simply Nietzsche. It's grounded, ingrained in the ideas. Jews should be ashamed of themselves for loving this in the modern world. It is what paves the road to Hitler. However, this idea is a redemption narrative, and it's an evolving thing. And so one of the things that evolves here is the Jewish thesis against the Greek antithesis, and therefore you get an evolution here. It happens first in Babylonia, in the captivity. Jew and Babylonian synthesis creates the Jewish scriptures. That was one of the ideas. These are not textual scholars carefully finding things in the text that nobody ever seen before. Wellhausen was reading Hegel into the scriptures and saying, well, if the Jews are in Babylon and if ancient religion is evolving, well then the Jews obviously co-opted Babylonian superior ideas, came up with a synthesis, and voila, you had all these different sources read back into it. That was a philosophical assumption. So how did this affect the theologians? We can see it in the textual work of F.C. Bauer, the doctrinal dissembling of David Friedrich Strauss, and the philosophical anthropology of Ludwig Feuerbach. So let me just mention those three names that directly are affected and working off of Hegel's synthesis. F.C. Bauer in textual scholarship, David Friedrich Strauss in Christology and overall theology, but I'll just put Christology because he's most famous for beginning the quest for the historical Jesus. And then Ludwig Feuerbach, who coined the phrase, you are what you eat, but he didn't mean what mommy meant. He meant a materialistic ideology, and he reduces religion to that, and he actually anticipates Freud. in his explanation for how religions evolve. So what did Bauer do? Bauer thought that the New Testament, so watch for Hegel, have your Hegel detectors on here, because you'll see that's exactly what they're reading into the scholarship. Bauer looked at the New Testament, and he saw very clearly, apparently what nobody else saw, that Peter and Paul were in fundamental disagreement. So that the Jewish thesis, Peter's Jerusalem ministry, gave way to the Greek antithesis, Paul's bigger, superior Christianity. The synthesis in this case was an illegitimate one, a power grab of the second century, since the Catholic Church made the two, the Jewish and the Greek, agree where in fact they did not, calling the phony unity of these writings the canon of Scripture. And even the book of Acts, according to Bauer, was a second century creation to make it look like Peter and Paul actually at the end of the day got together and can unify these ideas, which are in fact are not unifiable, except by 19th century German scholars. They can unify them. Strauss sat under both Schleiermacher and Hegel, and then eventually Bauer, and then taught at the University of Tübingen, and he would stand in antithesis to orthodoxy through the most radical criticism of the Bible yet, pitting the Christ of faith against the Jesus of history. So, let's turn this back down to 3 o'clock and notice that Kant's flow is still flowing. So that Strauss puts the Christ of faith, of orthodoxy, in the noumenal above the Jesus of Nazareth, the Jew, the human, the lowly Jesus that had been crowded out of orthodoxy from Nicaea to Chalcedon in 451. And he was made into this sort of Batman, to use the actual word of one of their scholars. A centaur, an unbelievable figure, divine and human going together, which can't go together. And so Christ was placed in the noumenal, Jesus in the phenomenal. The divine in the noumenal, the human in the phenomenal. Same idea in N.T. Wright and his Christology. Right out of 19th century liberalism. A neo-Nestorianism is what I call it. Well, Strauss would write the very scandalous Life of Jesus, critically examined in 1835, arguing with the rest of the Enlightenment that God could not incarnate into history. And arguing with Hume that the claim to resurrection by the New Testament authors was circular and irrelevant, reading their expectations of the Messiah into an event that can never be attested anyway. And this was no big deal to Strauss, who continued his work within the Lutheran Church, since Jesus stood in that dialectical stream described by Hegel. He was useful in his time, the most enlightened man at that time. What mattered was the truth that required that primitive step. And so he worked to give it this new legitimacy. Now, other things are going on this time. It's a very exciting time if you were a German young student that didn't care about orthodoxy at all. A long-lost book of the great Puritan poet Milton on doctrine, which was always known to exist, yet unknown as to its whereabouts or why it was left unpublished. Well, it was finally published in Latin in 1825, and it created quite a scandal. The book was called Two Books of Investigation into Christian Doctrine, Drawn from the Sacred Scriptures Alone. That's important in this era, from the Sacred Scriptures Alone. The title and its delay made sense. Milton himself was compelled to get behind the creed and find specifically two things. Because when you're getting behind the creed, you're looking for two things, usually Arianism and Unitarianism. The two doctrines that were the most fantastic and above the line there were the doctrine of the two natures of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity, which are so offensive to reason. Because apparently they can't figure out that two, in the case of the Trinity, one what and three who's. They apparently didn't know their law of non-contradiction in the 19th century, and so that was a big problem for them. But this was a find for the critic, these published writings, as it confirmed their own principle of textual criticism as the crowning achievement of the Reformation. These guys really thought they were the legitimate heirs of the Reformers. Because what was so great about the Reformers was that they criticized the text of orthodoxy going back to the original Greek texts. These are the kind of people that see Protestantism as a liberal innovation. And in their case, they liked it. And Rome as orthodoxy and conservative. And it's that simplistic for them. These are people that are one notch higher than animal level thinking. They were given like the control center of Western civilization. Now, Feuerbach took Hegel to a different extreme. Where the master, Hegel, had made reason the focus of evolution, Feuerbach would make material, matter, the focus of evolution. Again, Darwin's not quite ready yet. The only thing differentiating humans from animals, Feuerbach would say, is self-awareness. You don't want to say reason. It's self-consciousness. This is the distinguishing feature of religion, too. So in anticipation of Freud, Feuerbach would argue that God, or the God idea, is a projection of ourself. That which is higher in us than animals. The only thing that makes us higher than animals are awareness of ourself, and we project those higher qualities. What makes them higher? I would ask the same question I'd ask to Hegel. How do you know reason's off in the future? Are you sending us a postcard from there? Can you see it? I would say to Feuerbach, how do you know that that's higher than the cat's simple faith? The simplicity of animal. How do you know that that's higher or better? Well, Karl Marx was very much influenced by Feuerbach because he took Hegel's dialectic and eschatology and evolution of things, but instead of making it rational or purely material as Feuerbach did, Marx made it economic. So the thesis in one generation is the owners of the means of production. The antithesis is the labor, which really built everything for them, and that dialectic became what became known as conflict theory sociology, or eventually Marxism. So see where all these ideas are coming from. He said, where's the connection between Kant and the dead bodies? There's your connection. Both fascism and communism, and 200 million dead bodies. Christians fell asleep at the post and let these Fruit Loops run civilization. Now the central... I'll skip that. I was going to talk about the idea of culture war in Germany in the 19th century from these same guys. So there's a very conservative element to it. But it's political. It's not theological. I mentioned Wellhausen before. I won't get into him before. He's the guy that came up with the JEP. When I mentioned the documentary hypothesis, that's the same thing as the JEPD theory, that there's these different forms or sources for the Old Testament. That is a reading of Hegel into the text. It is not somebody who's just a Christian going away to seminary and just like who's the thing in the Little Red Riding Hood story? It's been so long since that's the way I was used to tell the story. It's just innocently going along to bring biscuits to grandma and boom, his Bible falls out and he turns to a problem passage and creates a crisis of faith. That's not the way it happens. These people are reading into philosophy, into the text, things that they already want to believe. So, then Darwin and other stuff, I'll get to it next time. I'd rather get to the frontier in session two. So let me stop there and take any questions on the origins of liberal theology and higher criticism.